You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 23rd, 2015. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. On today's show,
the concept that the Voting Rights Act is won in a single day or two at Selma is child's play, to be very frankly, when you look at it historically.
Coley Lafayette Clark started organizing in Selma for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee a full 2 years before Martin Luther King showed up. To mark 50 years since the Voting Rights Act, we'll look at the organizing that didn't make it into the movies and the lessons for today. But first,
we're not trying to make sure that everybody in the country gets laid. We're trying to make sure that every person who chooses to engage in a transaction where they exchange sex for money is able to do that.
A new lawsuit makes a constitutional case to throw out anti-prostitution laws. We'll dig into the arguments. That's all next this hour, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court has left intact a new Republican-backed law in Wisconsin that requires voters to present photo identification when they cast ballots. The court declined to hear an appeal filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. The court had blocked Wisconsin from requiring photo IDs in November's general election. The state will now be free to impose the requirement in the future. The Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether the Americans with Disabilities Act requires police to take special precautions when trying to arrest armed and potentially violent suspects who have a mental illness. The case before the justices involves San Francisco police and how they dealt with a woman with schizophrenia who had threatened to kill her social worker. Police forced their way into Teresa Sheehan's room at a group home and then shot her 5 times after she came at them with a knife. Sheehan survived and later sued the city, saying police had a duty under the Americans with Disabilities Act to consider her mental illness and take more steps to avoid a violent confrontation. Her attorneys say the federal law requires police to make reasonable accommodations when arresting people who have mental or physical disabilities. They say police could have used less aggressive tactics in the Sheehan case, such as waiting for backup and trying to talk to her in a non-threatening way. The Supreme Court case has attracted attention from mental health advocates who say failing to take account of a suspect's disability often results in unnecessary and frequently fatal shootings by police. Protests in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and San Francisco this weekend marked the 12-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. President Bush ordered the invasion in 2003 on the false claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. President Obama last week said the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq was an unintended consequence of the invasion ordered by Bush. Cameron Jones reports from Saturday's anti-war rally in San Francisco.
Hundreds rallied on Market and Powell streets to voice opposition to an escalating policy of U.S. aggression, intervention, and imperialism with no end in sight.
5 years later, we're still here!
Janet Wheel is with Code Pink.
I'm here along with all the hundreds of other people who are showing up to say no new AUMF, no new green light for another U.S. war against Iraq and now Syria, and also to say no war on Iran. We're furious about the warmongering in Congress against Iran. Young people especially need to step up and find their role in pushing back against a militarized U.S. foreign policy that is killing young people, both American and Middle Eastern in various countries, and is wrecking their future.
Activists say parallels exist between endless war, racism, and the widening gap of inequality.
That's Cameron Jones reporting. Multiple bombings in Iraq today killed at least 13 people and wounded 22. Officials say the deadliest blast struck a busy commercial street in Baghdad's Sadr City, killing at least 9 and wounding 22. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz has become the first major party candidate to announce he's running for president. Cruz announced his intentions on Twitter.
It's a time for truth. A time to rise to the challenge, just as Americans have always done. I believe in America and her people, and I believe we can stand up and restore our promise.
Cruz, who has backing from the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, plans to make a speech about his plans later today at the Christian College Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. Before Cruz formally announced his plans, California Governor Jerry Brown said the Republican senator's views on climate change make Cruz unfit to run for president. On Meet the Press, Brown responded to Cruz's remark that science doesn't support the warnings of what Cruz called global warming alarmists.
What he said is absolutely false. Over 90% of the scientists who deal with climate are absolutely convinced that the human activity, the industrial activity, the generation of CO2, methane, oxides of nitrogen, all the rest of those greenhouse gases are building up in the atmosphere, they're heat trapping, and they're causing not just warm drought in California, but severe storms and cold in the East Coast. Right. So it's climate disruption of many different kinds. And that man betokens such a level of ignorance and a direct falsification of the existing scientific data. It's shocking, and I think that man has rendered himself absolutely unfit to be running for office.
Brown said he would entertain making another bid for the White House himself if he were 10 years younger. Brown is 77. The foreign minister of Yemen today called for military intervention by Gulf countries to stop territorial advances by Houthi fighters who have captured the capital, Sana'a. The foreign minister said Yemeni officials had told the Gulf Cooperation Council, the United Nations, and the larger international community that there should be a no-fly zone and the use of military aircraft should be prevented at airports controlled by the Houthis. The UN mediator for Yemen said there is no military solution to the crisis. Jabal Ben Omar briefed the 15-member Security Council on Sunday and said Yemen has been pushed toward the edge of civil war.
It would be an illusion to think that the Houthis could mount an offensive and succeed in taking control of the entire country, including Marib, Taiz, and the South. It would be equally false to think that President Hadi could assemble sufficient forces to liberate the country from the Houthis.
Regional rivals Saudi Arabia and Iran back opposing sides in the conflict in Yemen, with the Saudis backing the ousted president and Iran backing the Houthi rebels. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, mostly cloudy and breezy, a chance of morning showers. It was raining earlier outside our Berkeley studios, highs in the 60s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly sunny, a 20% chance of morning showers, high 68 to 74 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on KPFA 94.1 at 7:30.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Next up, why should prostitution be illegal? That is the question at the center of a new lawsuit that has been filed by a collection of sex workers and a prospective client in San Francisco. Their attorneys will be arguing in federal court that it is in fact unconstitutional for our state government to tell consenting adults that they can't trade sex for money. Now, if they win, it could set a precedent that would radically change the way this country's laws treat sex work. Joining us in studio right now, we have two of the people involved in that suit. Maxine Dugan is a prostitute and president of the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project, or ESPLRP. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And lead attorney on the case, Gil Sperling. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So, Maxine, I want to start with you. Just kind of paint us a sketch of how the ban on prostitution that we have in effect in California affects you on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it affects everybody because it bans our right to negotiate for our own labor and our own safe work conditions. So essentially, I can't offer my services as an erotic service provider, as a prostitute, to exchange for any compensation, you know, mostly money or cash, because it's illegal under the prostitution law. And it's a misdemeanor in California. So frequently what happens is, under the fear of being arrested for prostitution, prostitutes will often have to not negotiate for our own labor and safe work conditions, which leaves a very precarious situation to operate in. And oftentimes it can lead to disagreements with customers about what exactly kind of service that they're going to be receiving or what's being offered. Also, police do these anti-prostitution sting operations under the guise of rescuing sex trafficked victims. And it's when we pull out our condoms, you know, which is our safety device on our job. It's often when we're arrested for prostitution.
You mean the condoms are used as evidence of prostitution?
Yes.
Now, the strongest arguments against decriminalizing prostitution have come from organizations that combat sex trafficking. And they say that these are the laws that let prosecutors break up, you know, rings that traffic in people, that smuggle underage women into this country.
It's not in anybody's best interest to be arrested for prostitution. The number one way that sex traffic victims are identified as such is they're arrested for prostitution. And it's a really ineffective means to identify sex traffic victims. Being arrested for prostitution is a violent act. You know, all of these sex trafficking laws have overly funded the police and really proliferated the prison industrial complex. And to be an actual traffic victim caught up in that system of rescue it's just counterproductive, and it's failed policy. And we have argued against it on numerous occasions in numerous venues and have lost. And that's why we're taking our case to the federal court.
So if you were to prevail in court and prostitution were to be legal in California, what tools would you see the powers that be using to combat actual sex trafficking?
Well, we see in our lawsuit, we're asking for the right to access our free speech, and we're asking for the right to equal protection under the law, and we're asking for the right to associate. You know, right now, because of the criminalization and sex traffic victims even being arrested for prostitution or at risk of being arrested for prostitution, it's oftentimes the client who is the first responder, and the client are oftentimes the ones who have to provide the ways and the means for somebody to make an exit or to, you know, get out of a situation that they don't want to be in terms of providing them money, providing them rides, providing them a phone, you know, to get on to their next right thing. So our lawsuit is really important because it will bring everybody, including sex traffic victims, their right to say yes and their right to say no.
Speaking about a new lawsuit that's been filed in federal court in San Francisco, seeking to overturn California's ban on prostitution as unconstitutional. You just heard from Maxine Dugan. She's a prostitute and president of the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project. We also have the attorney on that suit, Gil Sperling, with us in studio. Lay out the constitutional argument. How would the U.S. Constitution help throw out a California law?
Certainly. I'd be glad to respond to that. I want to return to your previous question for just a moment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And you presented it as the fear of human sex trafficking as being the strongest argument against prostitution laws. I don't know if it's the strongest, but it seems to be the one that pulls at most people's heartstrings. And certainly to the extent that anyone is trafficked for any reason, whether it's sex or agriculture or anything else, it's a serious issue that should be addressed. But when you drive economies underground, it makes it more difficult for police to uncover those situations. And just as an example, if a customer goes and witnesses some kind of evidence that suggests that the woman or man who he's having sex with is being trafficked or forced into the situation, he's at risk of being arrested himself if he reports that when it's criminalized.
Because it's like an admission of guilt.
Absolutely. And the same for the person who's in the trafficking situation. If they go to the police, they're at risk of being arrested, even though they're going to ask for help. They never know what's going to happen. And the people that would abuse people and keep them in those kind of situations leverage that. The same way that farm workers or manufacturers use people's immigration status as a means of controlling them and keeping them from going to the police. So while your question is a good question, I think it really should be asked in reverse, and that is, how does criminalization actually help those who are human trafficked?
Sure. Well, so let's stipulate from this point on that the trafficking doesn't have anything to do with the ban on prostitution, and talk about the actual constitutional issues. Why, from a constitutional perspective, should a state like California not be able to say no prostitution here?
This case is really based on the idea of substantive due process, which was really in its heyday and kind of reached its apex in the Roe v. Wade decision.
This is the 14th Amendment. It's one of the Reconstruction Amendments.
That's correct. And since that time, it kind of fell out of favor. It wasn't being received quite as well by the courts. But then in Lawrence v. Texas, which is the case where the Supreme Court overturned state laws criminalizing homosexual sexual conduct.
Sodomy laws.
Yes. That was based on substantive due process. And there the court essentially said, and it's a little unclear on how they followed their analysis. They didn't really lay it out 100% clearly. But what they did say was that morality alone can't be the basis for regulating intimate sexual relationships. And we think that applies here. We think that really when you strip away the arguments in favor of criminalizing prostitution, most of them fall pretty quickly, like a house of cards. And really, they're left with morality. And we think that really that is what drives a lot of people's interest in controlling other people's behavior, unfortunately, still in 2015.
But isn't the counterargument that they are not regulating a type of conduct, they're regulating a type of commerce? The substantive difference is that money's changing hands.
Well, that's correct. But if you look back at really some of the earliest cases that were based on substantive due process, they had to deal with birth control and birth control devices. And what the court said there was, even though you're regulating a product that's being bought and sold, it affects people's personal relationships and how they come together to have a sexual relationship. And here, it's really arguably the same thing. Although there is money being exchanged, you're really talking about an interpersonal relationship. And for many people, especially, one of our clients is severely disabled, and it's very difficult for him to make human contact in other ways. And he gets a lot of personal sexual fulfillment, emotional fulfillment, from engaging prostitutes. And we think that it's just not very American to step in and say, we're gonna say who you can have sex with and who you can't, and we're going to make that determination because money exchanges hand. I think we've all heard the comparisons to, a date where there's a nice dinner bought or a dinner and a show. And is that different from exchanging money, if there's an expectation of, some sort of sexual contact in return?
Well, an expectation is different from a contractual obligation to perform at the end of the night.
That's a point that's well taken, but it may be different. But but what really makes it that different? I mean, what if it was just a date where one party said, if you want to sleep with me, take me out to dinner, and I'll sleep with you. And how is that different? And would that be something that would be subject to the criminal statute? Actually, the way the statute's written, it would be, because it's not just cash. It's and I don't have the wording in front of me right now, but it's anything of value.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways to look at prostitution law. And one is that it's just kind of an expression of this American prudishness that wants to insert the government into people's bedrooms. But the other, and I'm sure there are some feminists in our audience who are thinking this, is that there are some things that should be outside of the marketplace, and human intimacy is one of them. There should be some things that can't be bought or sold. You're making a face, Maxine. What do you think of that?
I'm laughing, actually. I think that's part of the tired old moral argument about feminists, or some people who call themselves feminists, trying to regulate other people's sexual behavior. And it's unfeminist, actually, to try to put that argument forward, to say that these things are off limits in our society, when really, you know, it was on the backs of prostitutes that a lot of American cities and towns were built. And it wasn't until recently that prostitution was made criminal. And the only reason it's made criminal, and as we're seeing the latest version of criminalization in the sex trafficking laws, is because it's actually being used as a big red herring. It's actually being used as a way to keep people, the public, in moral panic over these ideas that, you know, innocent women, children are being abducted and forced into prostitution, when really there's already a healthy underground commerce that is going full blast, that doesn't have access to equal protection under the law. And so that's really what our lawsuit is about. You know, the problem is that criminalizing any other industry in this way is not being approached. Like, we're not talking about criminalizing selling agriculture. We're not talking about criminalizing Walmart shoppers, are we? You know, to single out our industry is just strictly, and to me, is nothing short of discrimination outright. You're discriminating against our class, and we want it to stop.
Yeah. What I wrestle with is that if you have an unfair economy that deprives people of the means of a basic subsistence and puts someone in a situation where she has to choose between selling her body and getting evicted from her apartment, it's hard to argue that under those circumstances she's making a totally consensual decision about what to do.
Right. And so we have a bunch of people who are working in other occupations who have to make the same decision every day. So, you know, people are going to jobs where they feel exploited. And there's no police sting operation trying to rescue them under, you know, by trying to arrest them for working at Walmart, for trying to pay their rent. So the issue really is here is about the concentration of wealth in our country that's in a few people's hands that nobody has access to. And so that's really the larger issue here. If you really care about forced labor in any industry, you'll be working on the anti-wealth campaigns, right? You know, to end poverty, because that is the solution to end poverty, is to redistribute the wealth in a more equitable way. And, you know, you just need to leave the rest of us who are sexually gifted and talented, you know, alone.
Can I add a little bit to that? Absolutely. To the extent that there is income inequality in the United States that causes people to work in any kind of job that they don't want to, we would love to see that addressed. We can't really wait till that happens, I don't think, for people that are trying to eat day to day. But I also want to make the point that not everybody thinks that this is a horrible job, and I think that's a misperception. A lot of people want the flexibility of the hours that they can work. They enjoy the work. There may be any number of reasons why they choose this work, because they want this job, not necessarily because they're forced into it. And I think that to continue that kind of stereotype plays into this, you know, a feminist idea that isn't really based in 100% truth. I'm not saying that there aren't certainly people that do have that unfortunate situation where they take whatever job they can, just like a drug dealer or somebody that has to work 18 hours a day at minimum wage at a hamburger place or whatever. There's lots of jobs that people don't think great. Some people would like those jobs.
Well, Maxine Dugan, how many people who you know in your profession would you say do the work out of sheer joy of the work, and how many are facing some amount of economic compulsion to do the work?
Well, you know, we don't have any good research on our industry, because getting funding for research on our industry is, I've had all the doors shut in my face. I've been soliciting universities. We have a ton of universities here in the Bay Area for help with doing some real good research. We don't even know how many people are working in the sex industry. We have no idea how old we are. We have no idea there's just some really lack of basic information. How many people are being arrested? How much money is law enforcement spending on arresting us? You know, how much money is the FBI agent who gets to pose as the naked customer in a prostitution sting operation under the guise of rescuing sex traffic victims, is he getting paid? You know, we know in San Francisco, we found a MOU where that said...
The Memo of Understanding.
Yes, that said that the San Francisco police officers were getting paid time and a half to run these prostitution sting operations. So, you know, it doesn't make good economic sense to continue to fund the criminalization of prostitution when we really need to restore the safety net in this country.
Couldn't you take the same arguments you've just made and say, for exactly these same reasons, people should be able to sell their kidneys on the open market?
I think the difference between selling your vagina and selling your kidneys is that you don't get your kidneys back after the transaction. You know, the deal with using your vagina is, you know, not everybody uses their vagina in a prostitution transaction, right? They might be using their mouth. They might be using their hands. They might be using their feet. They might be tying somebody up and just rubbing them with their breasts. You know, those are all considered lewd acts under the California criminal statute. And we think that that is wrong, and we're going to challenge it in federal court and have that hopefully voided.
Once again, I'll add a little something to that. You know, the laws that prescribe the buying and selling of body parts are there to protect the sick, to make sure that people have equal access to life-saving procedures and getting the donated organs. Here, the situation is kind of the reverse. We're not trying to make sure that everybody in the country gets laid. We're trying to make sure that every person who chooses to engage in a transaction where they exchange sex for money is able to do that. And I don't think there's any losers there like there would be in a kidney donation situation.
All right. Gil Sperling and Maxine Dugan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maxine Dugan is a prostitute and president of the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project, or ESPLRP. Gil Sperling is an attorney for the lawsuit that they have just helped to bring against the district attorneys in San Francisco, Alameda County, and the state attorney general for California, seeking to overturn California's ban on prostitution. And one thing I should mention before we close out this segment, you've been trying to crowdsource the funding for this lawsuit and been shut out by the platform you were using to raise the money. How did that happen?
We were discriminated against. You know, we had used GoFundMe to raise $30,000 for our attorneys, and that campaign had reached its goal last June. We had had additional donations through that campaign that, you know, where I received, you know, we received checks as of February, so we thought it was a good idea to go ahead and use that same crowdsourcing again. And on Monday, we set the settings up on the internet to restart that campaign, exact same campaign we had used before. And by Friday, they had not only shut that campaign down, but they deleted my whole account. So we had to scramble to go.
So they literally decided you're too hot to handle.
Well, you know, they said that they had changed their terms and conditions in September, which was odd because they were still giving money to us as of February. So we think it's just another example of the ways and means that the prostitution nation is being discriminated against. And that's why we brought this lawsuit. And that's why we included the right to associate in our lawsuit, because we want the right to associate and we want the right to not be discriminated against in accessing financial institutions.
So how are you collecting donations now?
We are collecting donations now at tilt.com, and our campaign is called liberatetoemancipate.tilt.com.
Tilt.com, liberate to emancipate. Thank you again, Maxine.
Thank you.
Our other guest was Gil Sperling. He's the attorney for the lawsuit that ESPLRP and others have brought. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Coming up on 7:30 in the morning, just want to remind you that we have two events coming up this week with neuropsychologist Mario Martinez. This Wednesday at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, and this Friday at the First Congregational Church of Oakland. Both events start at 7:30 in the evening. There's full details on our website, kpfa.org. When we return, we're going to go through some of the real history of Selma that did not make it into the movie. We'll speak to veteran SNCC organizer Coley Lafayette Clark. That's after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandary.
In a ceremony at the Pentagon, Afghanistan's president thanked U.S. troops and taxpayers for the U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan in nearly 14 years of war, the longest war in U.S. history. Defense Secretary Ash Carter welcomed Ghani and Afghan Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah at a ceremony at the Pentagon. Ghani addresses a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. President Obama is expected to announce a decision tomorrow on whether to slow the planned withdrawal of the 10,000 U.S. troops still on the ground in Afghanistan. Protests in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and San Francisco this weekend marked the 12-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
I'm here along with all the hundreds of other people who are showing up to say no new AUMF, no new green light for another U.S. war against Iraq and now Syria.
President Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the false claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. President Obama last week said the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq was an unintended consequence of the invasion ordered by Bush. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz has become the first major party candidate to announce he's running for president. Cruz announced his intention on Twitter.
It's a time for truth. A time to rise to the challenge, just as Americans have always done. I believe in America and her people, and I believe we can stand up and restore our promise.
Cruz has backing from the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. He's making a speech about his plans today at the Christian College Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. The U.S. Supreme Court has left intact a new Republican-backed law in Wisconsin that requires voters to present photo identification when they cast ballots. The court declined to hear an appeal filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, which challenged the law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has secured a majority of backers in the new parliament and will now be tasked with forming the next government. Israel's ceremonial president, Reuven Rivlin, was meeting today with the parties in parliament to hear their recommendations before appointing who will form the next coalition government. After a resounding election victory for his Likud party, Netanyahu was assured of being tapped. It became a formality after the new centrist party Kulanu gave its nod to Netanyahu as well, giving him 61 backers out of the 120 in parliament. A Vallejo police spokesman says an officer shot and killed a man who was later found to have a note in his truck apologizing to the police. Lieutenant Sid De Jesus said the confrontation started in a shopping center parking lot Saturday evening when someone called 911 to report an agitated man holding a large knife next to a pickup truck. De Jesus says the responding officer saw what would turn out to be a fake gun in the man's waistband and ordered him to drop the knife. The man refused. The officer then shot him. De Jesus says the note investigators found in the pickup apologized for the trouble he'd caused and to the officers he anticipated would fatally shoot him. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, mostly cloudy and breezy. There have been some scattered morning showers, highs in the 60s. In Fresno, in the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly sunny, 20% chance of morning showers. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news on KPFA 94.1 at 8 a.m.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. This summer marks 50 years since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, a victory won through bloody struggle in the streets of Selma, Alabama. Thanks to the new film Selma, that struggle has been immortalized and brought to a new generation. But the film focuses almost exclusively on the role of Martin Luther King Jr. And to be sure, he was the most iconic civil rights leader involved, but he was only in Selma for about 2 months. Our next guest moved to Selma more than 2 years before the famous Selma to Montgomery marches. She worked as an organizer for a new radical civil rights group, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Coley Lafayette Clark has led an extraordinary life of activism since then, working on everything from Haiti to international debt relief to building third-party power here in the United States. She's run for U.S. Senate twice in New York, both times on the Green Party ticket. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. Your show is powerful, I understand, in the region, so I am very delighted to be here.
Well, all the more powerful for having you with us. Tell us what it was like moving to Selma.
It was 63. We were newlyweds, Bernard Lafayette and Coley, and Reverend Bernard Lafayette and his wife, Coley Lafayette. I'd been a special assistant to Medgar Wiley Evers in Mississippi within AACP, and I left Medgar in 62 and joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I wanted to be with my peer group, and that's where I went. And I worked in Mississippi, a very powerful summer and coming into the fall. And it's important that we talk about that, because the concept that the Voting Rights Act is won in a single day or two at Selma, it's child's play, to be very frankly, when you look at it historically. You have to keep the voting rights victory within the last 10 years. The last 10 years, from 55 when Dr. King kicks off Montgomery to 65 when there is the march on the Selma Bridge. These are all highlight points. There is only 5 years when there's quietness, and that is the 5 years between the end of the Montgomery March and the beginning of the student revolution. So in that interim, we get the birth of the Civil Rights Commission, the first Congressional Civil Rights Commission with no nothing but investigative powers, no ability to do anything other than that. In that interim, we get the birth of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In that interim, we get the Little Rock Nine. There are some deaths in Mississippi, lynchings that are very key, but we don't need to go there right now. 59, we get what's called the last lynching, the lynching of Mac Charles Parker at Poplarville, Mississippi. And Dr. Martin Luther King is off to India to study nonviolence with the greats. So 60 begins a very revolutionary moment when those kids sat down at the lunch counters and young people took control of the movement. Young people set the agenda straight through to 65. So either we can do a reevaluation, kind of like technique where you start from 65 and come back, or we can start and go forward. I would prefer we start and go forward so that we don't have a misunderstanding of what Selma was. Selma is just an incident. It's the last one. It's a great one. But is Selma more powerful than the sit-ins? You know, we have to ask those questions. Otherwise, Selma will be used to blind us. Selma will be used to avert our attention away from another great moment like that one in 60. And that great moment in 60 was when youth took over. And last August at Ferguson, Missouri, youth took over. So I don't want to see that incident, those incidents on the bridge at Selma, with obviously a powerful campaign. We're not going to argue against that. But a campaign obviously organized by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Dr. King, and not the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It's Dr. King, the institution that comes to Selma, Alabama. These are SNCC people who are on the bridge.
So tell me about that organizing work. First of all, why did SNCC pick Selma to send you to?
We didn't pick Selma. Selma picked us. The Dallas County Voters League went out trying to get someone to come in and help with organizing of the Black Belt Alabama project. It worked on a bunch of issues, but it developed some leadership locally in Selma, leadership in the county of Dallas, where Selma is the county seat. So obviously the league had decided to reach out, and they asked Dr. King, and they said no. It was too dangerous, and they thought at the time there should not be any move in Alabama. That was because it had Birmingham. Birmingham had been very dangerous. So they'd come through Selma in 61 on a people-to-people tour. And I think they might have done another one. They'd always get shot at. You know, it was a dangerous moment. People were worried about King's life, and they should have been. So they reached out to Corps. They reached out to wherever they could reach. But there was only one group in the South, crazy enough folk out there, one group who feared nothing, really. We decided we had committed our lives to nonviolence philosophy. We committed our lives to making change in the United States. We committed our lives to a Voting Rights Act, and we were willing, prepared, and able to do that. So we start. We got into Selma at 10:15, February the 10th, 1963. And then at 10:30, we reach Torch Motel. And then at 10:45, there's a loud knock at the door, and we can see two tall white men. And the last thing two young black kids want to see tonight is two tall white men. So we didn't know, but we knew that the walls were paper shell. No sense in us keeping them out there. We might as well let them in. So we opened the door, and they introduced themselves as being deputy attorney generals for the United States Justice Department and did show us their credentials. They came to get us out. They just discovered completely, perfectly clear evidence that we were to be killed. And immediately, so we should leave before they came to kill us. So we said to them, "You're the U.S. Justice Department?" They said, "Yes." We said, "Go arrest them." And they said to us, "Well, we're the Justice Department." We said, "Yeah, the Department of Justice, right?" And they said, "Yes, but we don't do police work. That's left to the state and local authorities." When we, of course, told them we would be there, waiting on our killers. We were not leaving. We would be working. They could catch us out in the field organizing people. They could catch us in the hotel. Wherever they caught us, we were not leaving. We were super snick. Snickers don't leave. We don't sneak out. That's SCLC. And so we hunkered in for the evening, as far as we were concerned. So they made us even a proposition that we could spend 2 years at private colleges, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. We could choose. We could spend 2 years studying the junior ambassador program. We'd get assigned to some embassy somewhere. So we were really just like looking at each other, you know, like, whoa, wow. How cute. Gee, what else is on the plate? $1 million? Something else. But they also informed us after a while, after all the game was up, and they could see that we were not going anywhere, that they had filed suit. The Justice Department filed a suit for the right to vote in 1961. They didn't want us to disturb the spirit of their racist judge and have it to negatively affect the lawsuit.
So they told you, we will give you tuition to the best colleges in the country.
It was actually a program. I think that Condoleezza Rice and all of those others had some association with it.
And they told you, if you stay, you will set back the cause by provoking the ire of this judge.
That's
and
correct.
On top of that, they said, if you stay, you'll probably get killed.
That's right.
And you stayed.
And we stayed. We always knew we'd probably get killed. I mean, what's new? We're black. We're in America. We've been in America all of our lives.
So what did the work of actually organizing those seven counties look like?
You know, we got off to a quick start, making sure we met the chief of police, because his four police officers would stay two in a car, and they only had two cars and trace us around. So we went to see the chief of police. They didn't know we were going, and they was not too bright men, so they followed us as we took them back to their headquarters, where we parked in the slot marked chief of police. And we went in and talked with the chief of police. This means we introduced ourselves. We got off to a quick start. We are now in Selma. And from there, we began to meet. So we're off to trying to get a feel of the spirit of the place where our headquarters are. But we got housing, and then we were off to organizing the town, trying to find folk to talk to. Bernard stumbled upon six youth in the street, and he brought them to the house. And that's where the movement begins, with these six young people, with us getting them into nonviolence training, with us talking with them about how we were going to not only organize Selma and Dallas County, but also how we were going to organize the other seven Black Belt counties, well, the other six counties. And from there, we're off to, with the organizing with the youth are putting out the word, we're in town. We're in town. But we need to get to adult leadership. And we were not able to move immediately any of the black preachers in town. Finally, we get a preacher named Lewis Lord Anderson. And Lewis Lord Anderson is willing to open up his church basement to allow the use of his piano to train the youth. Not only that, we get a real lucky strike, a Catholic priest. There was a Catholic diocese locally, and he was in charge of the diocese. And that Catholic priest invited all the black preachers. The white man said, come, you come. And he invited all the black preachers, and most of them showed. Methodists, Baptists, United Church of Christ. And I loved that evening because he had alcohol everywhere.
Good Catholic.
And they were drinking. had to sit there and to hold your hand and pretend you don't take a drink sometimes. It was really cute. But we had a moment. We talked with a priest who was serious. He lost a brother in World War II. He had a full commitment to change. After that meeting, Reverend Louis Lord Anderson decided he would take us to another county. He was very excited, and he does take us to another county. And the other county will be where the movement begins. And that county is Wilcox County. For the folk who have seen the film, they'll see Jimmie Lee Jackson. Jimmie Lee Jackson does not get shot in Dallas County, which houses Selma. He gets shot in Wilcox County at Camden with a sheriff far worse than Jim Clark could ever dream of being. Lumley Jenkins, known for his killings of black folk, known for his extraordinary violence in every place but one. And that was an area surrounded by 60 miles of cypress swamp and the Alabama Coosa River, where blacks, we were told, were freed from slavery. At least they saw themselves as being freed from slavery when the person who owned their plantation died in 1928, Pettway. But those people and their cousins from Alberta County will be the first blacks in the area to go down to register to vote in more than 50 years. And we'll take them three times. They exhibited a courage that I've seen among very few people. When the word got out to the other counties that indeed these people who were least likely to try to register to vote not only went in and tried, but tried with great courage, it affected Dallas County. And our youth now want to do demonstrations. Everybody wants to do something different. And the Great Spirit was doing what it wanted to do. Brother who had been a reverend, Louis Lord Anderson, had been in a car accident. And in that car accident, he was just short of death. The other brother, driving the car for Carter Drugstore, was killed in the accident. So they charged him with murder and were taking him up for the death penalty. He's fighting for his life. Pulled him through the streets where the crowds came out and screamed, "Crucify him!" just before Easter. "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And all for what? Because Anderson had been asked when he came. They got this man with numbers of master's degrees, very popular, you know, the deputy in command for the National Baptist Convention coming to Selma to take up the most elite church in Selma, the Tabernacle. So the white radio stations invited him. There were no other radio stations. And they sent him the topic they wanted him to speak on to be sure he didn't say what they didn't want him to say. And they wanted him to speak on what does a Negro want. And he did. And he did so reverently. The Negro does not want to drive around in big fine carriages while his brother walks around in mud and slime. The Negro does not want to live in big fine mansions while his brother lives in shanties and shacks and poverty and homeless. So that really got the ire of the local ones. And they were very, very upset. So now they had him. But the case was fought by Jack Greenberg from the Legal Defense Fund of NAACP. And went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the case was remanded back to the state of Alabama, meaning they sent it back down to the lower court. And now the lower court had a right to take it up. And since he was involved with the Lafayettes and involved with talking about voter registration and voter education and having young people trained in nonviolence in his church, they called him on the carpet. He is not mentioned in your film. It is an insult to humanity, to anything that we could dream of around the building of a movement in Alabama, for Reverend Louis Lord Anderson, who will be the key for setting off the mass meetings at Selma, Alabama. And we will run them all summer long. So here we were with information from the FBI and also from local other local folk that this sheriff had deputized young white males 18 to 19 and that those young white males were at some kind of a factory where they were cutting 2x4s. So they were going to cut these 2x4s 18 inches long and they were going to be used on the heads of anybody coming to the rally. This was all over. All over. Now, I like to talk about history being a slow driving rain. When Fannie Lou Hamer came into the movement in Mississippi in 62, such a rain just started to happen that evening, August the 30th, 62. And here it is, and we get a slow driving rain. As I go ahead, all I can see is people. The rain stops at exactly 7, the time that the mass meeting is to begin. So it's a mystical moment. I see Sheriff Clark for the first time. Oh, he seemed to be a formidable fifth figure of some sort. I don't care. He was screaming at the deputy sheriff to get in the church. I want you to get in there. And the deputy kept coming back. This deputy was real sweet. A man who was totally illiterate. But he was to go in the church and to take his little box, I guess some kind of little microphone system, and just stay in there. Walk around, he says. Walk around. Well, the poor man didn't walk around. He got in the door trembling. He stood there looking at folk. He was embarrassed. He was really, truly embarrassed. But the church is packed. And just as I come up to go up the steps, I look to my left behind the hedges where the brothers with the guns, who did not believe in nonviolence, thought we were nuts. The Alabama High 12 for Dallas County. So it was a great beginning. It begun just a series of mass meetings, and everybody will come. Howard Zinn will come. Ella Baker, the mother of the civil rights movement, will come. James Bevel will come. We will have nothing but speakers. John Lewis will come. All of these speakers will come to Selma to delight and educate the people of Selma. 100 strong, beginning June 63. There was struggles between SNCC and SLCC at Alabama when Dr. King eased in the door. But why was Dr. King in the door? Don't be fooled, folk. 64 was a big year. This was the Democratic National Convention. This was the Mississippi Summer Project, which was already begun, and the Democratic National Convention happened and right amidst that project. This was Fannie Lou Hamer speaking at Atlantic City. This was the voting rights moment that will secure the Voting Rights Act. It didn't take anything but a breath of strong air, and you would have a Voting Rights Act.
So what drew the SCLC down to Selma when it did come?
They lost the campaign at Port Augustine, Florida. Now, we lose campaigns all the time, so they're accustomed to losing campaigns. But the problem was that they lost their fundraiser base. There was tons of money that came in with the Mississippi Summer Project, just didn't go to SCLC. So the first 2 months of 65, they show up at Selma. Where King goes, the press comes. The rest of us, we couldn't get any press at all in Selma when we had hundreds of students in jails in Selma, Alabama, got to one point where they opened up the old National Guard armor and threw them up in there because they had to have space to put young people. But that we couldn't get press. But when Dr. King comes to Selma, the press comes with him.
SNCC didn't actually endorse the marches from Selma to Montgomery.
Not initially, but SNCC was a full participant in the march from Selma to Montgomery. A full participant.
So explain how the relationship worked between SNCC.
They were always struggling again. We'd always struggled with SCLC from its inception in 60, when SCLC actually financed SNCC's headquarters. SNCC had a struggle with people trying to dictate it to us, to tell us what to do, when, and how to do it. And there was always this very clear division between us, and yes, this love affair. You put your hand on Dr. King, you're going to get your butt whipped. I mean, as simple as that. But we'd be angry with him. We'd be calling him the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. Some of us also did not understand roles and functions. We thought that Dr. King should be organizing in the field, getting out here working, being in these cotton fields and cane fields and in these little huts and stuff that we had to go into. But that should not have been his role, because it wasn't his role. His role, he was really the voice for a movement. He was an interpreter. He actually explained all of our actions ultimately with the press. And even though we did those things too, he had already captivated the press and held that role down until his death. We created the story, we created the script, we created everything that he would lead. SNCC was the leader for that.
But in the end, it took both.
Yes.
Speaking with Coley Lafayette Clark, a lifelong civil rights activist who began working as an organizer with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Selma, Alabama in 1963. I want to take the story up to the present.
Okay.
When we started talking, you identified Ferguson as another moment where the youth are out leading everyone else.
That's correct. What we have happening is with Ferguson, we got the foot soldiers who have kicked off a major campaign, and all of the leaders come running in. You know, you've told them to go home. Thank God. It is time after 50 long years we have been waiting for a new leadership. Doing what we didn't do at SNCC. 830 communities in the street at one time across this country. That is remarkable. Let these young people move forward and let us begin to do what we should have already done, have not done. And that is pass a complete, wholesome legacy to the next generation. Not only our successes and our failures, but also what happened to our families. What happened to us as human beings? They need to know that. That is our responsibility. We have that as an ultimate goal that we must pass to these young people. And we must remind them, in the words of Ella Baker, that the movement is bigger than a hamburger. The movement is bigger than Ferguson. That is our job. That's what we should be doing.
What's different today? What's missing?
What is missing is the old church is missing. We had a place to meet in the old church. And young people had the support of the old church. Now, I'm not talking about all the church. I'm talking about a very small percentage of churches. But we knew that that was there. What's missing is that the colleges that we came out of the South have been colonized by the powers that be. So they're not the same colleges that produce the young people that they produced in yesteryears. What's missing today are the Masons, who have never been celebrated, because when we couldn't go to the church, we had the Mason Halls. In fact, Medgar's office was located in the Masonic Temple in Jackson. We don't have that connection. So the connection between the elder and the young is missing today. That wholesome link that was there when I came along, that's missing today. But what's wholesome today is that Occupy, which was primarily white youth leadership, has joined with Ferguson, joined with New York, joined with Cleveland. That is what's there today. So, I mean, we may have these things that's missing, but young people are not afraid to work together, not afraid to be together, not afraid to scheme and plan together, not afraid to stand up.
It also seems like this generation of organizers does not have the same commitment to long-term organizing. I don't know of someone like you who moves to organize for a period of years.
I've had a lifetime of organizing. That's my job. But remember, we started out with a philosophy. This was lifetime work. You would not change a racist society in a generation. That we should prepare for lifetime work. And then when I went to the student movement, it was there and their philosophy and their goals and objectives. This is lifetime work. So therefore, the focus of SNCC was on family. And then we get a kick out of it because you got $8 a week when you got it. I only got it twice a week to take care of yourself versus $40 for a married couple. Because SNCC was hell-bent on building family. So that the movement would be there for the next generation.
Colette Lafayette Clark, thank you so much for coming in.
And thank you for having me. You're terrific. You let me wander.
Colette Lafayette Clark has been wandering for a long time as a civil rights activist. She began working as an organizer with SNCC in 1963, among other places, in Selma, Alabama. And that does it for today's show. Upfront is a production of the KPFA News Department. We're here weekday mornings at 7 a.m. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you heard in the show or suggest something for us to cover, the best way to get in touch is to send an email, upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Eileen Alfandary is our executive producer and our news editor. Linda Hoori is our interim producer. Caitlin Yoshiko-Candiel is a production intern. Kirsten Thomas is on the controls. And my name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Coming up, Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar. Stay tuned.
colonialism, independence, and Pan-Africanism. Dr. David Anthony of the History Department at UC Santa Cruz joins Africa Today on Monday evening at 7 p.m. on March 23rd and April 6th to discuss African history and independence since World War II. Dr. Anthony highlights post-World War II Africa, the early years of independence, Pan-Africanism, and the challenges of development. Join us for this special two-part series on Africa Today, KPFA 94.1, Mondays, March 23rd and April 6th. Amandra.